Jeffrey Denny, Reel 5. Did you remain as an instructor for the rest of the war?
I started off after I passed out professionally for leading seamen. I was put on the list of leading seamen instructors for new entries in the barracks at Portsmouth. The classes of about something between 20 and 30 came over from HMS St Vincent in Gosport, where they'd been originally accepted into the Navy and given their uniform and whatnot, and then they came over into the barracks at Portsmouth to be trained or told what the Navy was all about and, you know, what their job was to be. And so as a leading seaman instructor, I had to take a short course to make myself aware of what I've got to teach them, and then I found that I've got a class of 20 to 30 raw recruits to act as mother hen to keep them on the straight and narrow and to learn to be sailors ready to go to sea. So I had that job for best part of a year, I suppose it was. This was in 43 and 44, I suppose. And then in the end of 1944, the training lieutenant commander in Barrett, in the training division, he got fed up with having a master at arms drafted to the training division for a short time and then losing him when he was drafted off to sea. And so he thought, well, I'm not going to put up with this everlastingly changing, and so I want one of my killicks, which was the leading seaman, to be the acting master at arms for the training division. And they looked around and they decided that I'd make a good acting master at arms. And so I moved into the office there where we dealt almost exclusively with leave passes and what to do with classes when they finished their courses and that sort of thing. And there was no disciplinary side to the training division, because the majority of the youngsters, you know, they behaved themselves and there was no crime or absenteeism or anything like that. And so I was given this job as a clinic master at arms in the barracks in Portsmouth, and that was a great thing because I had a rubber stamp which said Master at Arms Training Division, and I just stamped any bit of paper I could see with that and signed it, and that was my pass to get out of the gate to go when I liked and however long for. And so I stuck that out for, until I was, my agent service group number 26 came up and I was to be demobilised.
As an acting master at arms, did you have any special uniform? Or
no. Nothing to say, I was a master. I didn't even have an armband with noble peace on it or anything like that at all. It's just that I had a rubber stamp which was of more use to me than a master at arms crowns on the on the lapels of my chief petty officer's jacket if I had one hand.
Did you get an increase in pay to reflect your...
No, I was still a master at arms. I think I was probably getting, I don't know, 5 shillings a day or something like that. I mean, as the leading seaman's rate of pay at those times. And
when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that some of the recruits were staying on the Victory.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, the Victory ship, as it was known then, because the naval barracks in Portsmouth was Victory, but Nelson's old ship in the dockyard, that was known as Victory ship, and they had a class there who were victualled and accommodated there because of the overcrowding in the barracks, and so they used to march from the barracks down Queen Street into the main gate of the dockyard, and they were victualled on board, and they had the same routine as anybody else, except that they were living where Nelson had, and where he was shot, and on the deck, and where he fell, and everything like that. And I went down to Victory ship, and not having anything better to do, I stayed the night on board, and when people, talk about the Victory ship years afterwards and that sort of thing, that do you, and what you know about Victory, Nelson's Victory, I said, oh yes, I slept on board her sort of business, and of course that shuts them up straight away, but that gives me quite a insight into what people are interested in the Navy in Portsmouth,
You said that you were demobilised.
Yeah.
So when was that?
I was demobilised in October 1945, having done 6 years and a month or something in the Navy, and from the I said goodbye to the barracks, and we went up to Stamshaw Camp, which is a naval temporary place up to the north of Portsmouth, and there they started the demobilisation routine, and that was, well, first of all was the medical, where they were a bit more precise than they would have been on the people joining. I mean, when you joined the Navy, if you could breathe and stand upright, I mean, you were passed as fit. But when we were demobilised, they did in fact give you a fairly, well, not exhaustive, but a fairly thorough examination to make sure that there was literally nothing wrong with you, because otherwise you could have come out of there afterwards and said, well, look, when I was discharged from the Navy, I'd only got one leg or something like that, or I was suffering from TB or what have you. But anyway, they passed me fit there, and then from then the last thing that happened was that in the camp at Stanfield, they had a final sort of meeting or muster, and there was a naval commander was supposed to have come along and said goodbye and good luck to you, but I don't know, for some reason or other, he didn't appear. I think he got something else to do, and so I was never thanked for my service or anything like that. And the next thing I knew was I was put on a lorry up to a big hall in Cosham, which is just up the road from Portsmouth, where they served out the demob suits, you see. And the majority of the people in those days had a grey demob suit with a light grey stripe on it. And, you know, people like myself who came out, they wore that as a sort of a demob uniform when they got back into Civvy Street. But I was looking through the suits and I saw one which was in a nice sort of, I think they called it a Prince of Wales tweed, but anyway, that was a much better suit, and it wasn't so obvious what it was. And they gave me a trilby hat, and which I was friendly with a farmer up close to Horsham. I used to go and help him on his farm, and I gave him this navy trilby hat. He used to wear it when he was feeding his pigs, you know. that was it. But anyway, I got a pair of shoes and a raincoat and a railway ticket to go home, and was paid off with a magnificent sum of, or whatever it was due to me, only a matter of 30 shillings or something like that, and they said that they'd send my final pay to my home address, which they did, and that was only a fairly small amount, but I did get a gratuity at the end of the war. If I remember rightly, that was £73, you know, for 6 years devoted service and undetected crime, you know. So that was the Navy in finished, and I went back to, as a veteran, back to the job which I'd done before, you know, and I stayed there for 4 years, and then I got married and got a job in London, and I completed my accountancy qualification there, and I worked for General Motors Limited there for 7 or 8 years, I suppose, and then they moved their offices out to Dunstable, and I didn't want to go there, and so I took redundancy pay there, and then went and worked for British Gas in their head financial department there, and I was a chartered management accountant there, and I stayed there until I was put on pension just coming up to 65, and that was the last time I saw of office work in London.
Can I ask you how well you, or not, you adjusted to civilian life? Did you find it a problem or difficult after being in the Navy for so long?
No, I don't think so. The job I had in back in Horsham was, well, there was no sort of stress to it or anything. I mean, it was a family business and I got on fairly well. I mean, I didn't sort of feel that I'd got to be doing this, that or the other. I mean, I just went back and well, did what I was required then.
Going back to your time at sea, aboard the Ark Royal, do you have any memories or stories about any of the ship's company?
Don't think so, nothing, nothing exciting or anything like that. I mean, we were pretty heavily bombed at one time or another, but I mean, it was nothing you can do about that except that if there's an aeroplane coming over going to drop a bomb on you, you hoped he was going to miss, you know, and that was the happened. We knew that the routine for doing the mortar convoys and that, we knew when the Italians were going to come over and bomb us or the Germans, and well, I mean, we thought, well, that'll be tomorrow morning when they come, and well, we just well, accepted it. There was nothing we could do. I mean, we knew where we got to go, and they knew where we were going to be at that time, and so that all happened as we expected it. There was a anti-invasion course where people were sort of drafted onto to for a week or so to see to learn what they might be called upon to do during, if there was an invasion. That was after, well, be about 1941, I suppose. No, it was after I got back to barracks, so it'd been 1942 when there was still an invasion scare on. There was a very old commissioned gunner who'd joined the Navy in the days of sail in soon after 1900, I suppose, that sort of time. And he'd come all the way up through the ranks, and he'd retired. And when he was recalled in 1939, he was made up to a commissioned gunner. I mean, he'd been a warrant officer, and they were, he normally wouldn't get any further, but I mean, as they, during the war, they promoted people to commissioned rank, and he, as a old gunner, as part of the anti-invasion course, he demonstrated the Maxim gun, which you know is was a 1914 gun, 1914-18 gun, and also the Lewis gun, which was a bit more usual. But anyway, he was too old to go to sea, and they found him a job as an instructor on the anti-invasion course. And the other weapon which we were instructed on, I was listening, I was an instructor behind him more or less. I wasn't on the receiving end of this instruction. He had a sticky bomb, which the Dad's Army people used, I believe. But anyway, it was about the size of a big grapefruit, full of explosive. And the idea was that anybody who was brave enough or foolhardy enough would be expected to go out onto the streets of Portsmouth and ram this sticky bomb in the tracks of a German tank or an armoured car. And this sticky bomb was coated with birdlime to make it stick where it got to the to wherever it was going to be placed. And after he'd completed his lecture with showing how this sticky bomb worked, he went to the heads to spend a penny. And when he came back, he was in some distress because he'd got bird lime on his genitals. And he was an old man, you know, and he was fidgeting about it. This was a similar man who'd been man and boy in the Navy, and he'd been recalled, and he was too old to go to sea again. And his name was Horn, and he was known in the Navy as Trader Horn, because the Navy would find a name for anybody or everybody. And he was officer of the watch in the barracks in Portsmouth. And round about 1942, occasionally there were, I won't say distressed, but sailors from foreign countries came to barracks and said, "Look, I'm a Norwegian sailor and I've got away from Norway, or Dutchman or French or what have you." And so they came, and they, old Trader Horn, had difficulty in talking to them, and so he broadcast on the tannoy, "Anybody who can speak German or Danish or anything reports to the officer of the watch." And so we had a very young and keen candidate who thought he was, might have been a commission candidate, and he said, "Please, sir, I can speak German, you see." "And I can speak French." And so the officer of the watch said, "Well, look, I don't want anybody who can speak French, I want somebody who can speak German." And so this young CW candidate, he said, "Well," he says, "on the east coast of France, where it's close to Germany, they're sort of semi-bilingual there." He says, "I think I might be able to speak the language that they speak in Alsace, you see." He says, "Well, look," he said, "if he comes from that part of the world, he may be an Alsatian, you see." And Trader Horn immediately said, he said, "I want somebody who can speak German." He said, "I don't care if he's a bloody Irish wolfhound. I want somebody who can speak German."
Just to conclude, can you tell me what it was like living in Portsmouth during the war?
Well, I think the civilians had a pretty rough time with the bombing in Portsmouth and thereabouts. The barracks in Portsmouth had been hit, but not very much. But the snag of being in the barracks in Portsmouth was that if there was an air raid every night, you had to turn out of your hammock and go into the air raid shelters, which had been dug underneath the parade ground in Portsmouth barracks. And that meant that you never really got a decent night's sleep at all. And that was the, well, apart from the general crowding and the fact that it was a Victorian type establishment, you know, it wasn't a very happy or comfortable place for anybody who was in transit there. I mean, it's all right for me because I was able to get away from it for the jobs that I was doing.
Thank you.